There are reasons for your commitment to be made now. For as the rush of hours and days and months grows stronger, the will to commit grows weaker. Events soon to transpire on this planet will dry up the options for the lukewarm. For the issues raised by Jesus are irrepressible issues.
The coming decades will be times of despair. Why? Because, as Moroni said, despair comes of iniquity. The more despair, the more iniquity. And unless there is a widespread repentance, despair will both deepen and spread, except among those who have gospel gladness. Alas, brothers and sisters, we likewise live in a time when the love of many will wax cold. Fear will therefore increase. Why? Because when men fear, it is because we are not perfect in love. The less love, the more fear, as well as the more war. Much sifting, therefore, will occur because of lapses in righteous behavior, which go unrepented of. A few will give up instead of holding out to the end. A few will be deceived by defectors. Likewise, others will be offended. For sufficient unto each dispensation are the stumbling blocks thereof. A few will stumble because in their preoccupation with the cares of the world, they do not have oil in their lamps. And again, those who refuse to eat their spiritual spinach will come off second when they wrestle with the world. Some, because of the scorn of the world, will grow ashamed and let go of the iron rod. A few who have not been saints, but merely tourists passing through, will depart from the path. A few, failing to be of good cheer, will even charge God foolishly. Such spreading pessimism does not necessarily mean back to the catacombs for Christians, or that secular Caesars will soon reopen the Colosseum. But already there are would-be Caesars who will refuse to settle for citizens who render to Caesar only that which is his, and unto God all that is his. The Lord described how he will bring his latter-day work forth out of obscurity and darkness. Thus, as foreseen, Christ and his work are becoming a light which can no longer be hidden. This emerging reality brings with it its own set of challenges and opportunities. For instance, though the gospel light is small, the adversary knows what it signifies, hence his disproportionate efforts to dim it. In the last days, in case you hadn't noticed it, discipleship is to be lived in crescendo. Our adversities and extremities will merely bring out the strong simplicities and the reassuring realities of the gospel. If ever a generation needed to be saved from itself, ours does. Surely these needs will intensify as the bewildered and beset nations of the earth, as foreseen by Jesus, wallow hopelessly in distress with perplexity. Future revelations, brothers and sisters, will include astounding events as well as great and important truths, so much so that Moses' and Israel's exulting song after safely crossing the Red Sea and the prophet Joseph's 1842 litany will gladly give way to the crescendo of glorious events associated with Christ's coming in majesty and power. The valley of Adammon-Diomon will ring again, this time with the sounds of dispensational reunion, as it glows with gathering. We have surely been warned and forewarned about our time, a period in which the compression of challenges may make a year seem like a decade. Members will be cleverly mocked and scorned by those in the great and spacious building, representing the pride of the world. No matter. For ere long, he who was raised on the third day will raise that spacious but third-class hotel. Ours will even be a time of great inversion as well as perversion. Some will call good evil and evil good. Others, in their ignorance of spiritual truths, will speak evil of those things which they know not. He who analogized that the wicked are like the troubled sea which cannot rest also knows where and when, in latter days, The sea's tidal waves will heave themselves savagely beyond their bounds. Two especially interesting words are used in the Bible to describe Noah's time: violence and corruption. Violence and corruption, seldom strangers to the human scene, appear to be increasing today. Some of the coarseness and cruelty present at the time of Noah will be replicated, for the love of many will wax cold. Also, peace will have been taken from the earth. In the last days, happily, the church will grow extensively, with its membership being scattered upon all the face of the earth. Nevertheless, its dominions will still be comparatively small because of wickedness, which will close the ears of many to the gospel message. There will also be a great division among the people. This stressful polarization will, ironically, help in the final shaking of that strange confederacy, the kingdom of the devil, in order that the honest in heart, even therein, may receive the truth. Not only in the years ahead, but even now, mortal self-sufficiency will be confounded. Profound fear will eventually pervade this perplexed planet. Would that mankind could live in faith, not fear, and with gratitude, not forgetfulness. The last days will be rampant with the cardinal sins, just as in the days of Noah. Society in the days of Noah, scriptures advise, was corrupt before God and filled with violence. Corruption and violence. Sound familiar? Both of these awful conditions crest because of surging individual selfishness. When thus engulfed, no wonder men's hearts in our day will fail them because of fear. Even the faithful can expect a few fibrillations. Moreover, all his purposes will come to pass in their time. However, without these latter and other spiritual perspectives, see how differently we behave. Take away an acknowledgement of divine design, and then watch the selfish scurrying to redesign political and economic systems to make life pain-free and pleasure-filled. Misguided governments mean to live, even if they live beyond their means, thereby mortgaging future generations. Take away the regard for the divinity in one's neighbor and watch the decline in our regard for his property. Take away basic moral standards and observe how quickly tolerance changes into permissiveness. Take away the sacred sense of belonging to a family or community and observe how quickly citizens cease to care for big cities. Take away regard for the seventh commandment and behold the current celebration of sex. The secular religion, with its own liturgy of lust and supporting music. Its theology focuses on self. Its hereafter is now. Its chief ritual is sensation, though ironically, it finally desensitizes its obsessed adherents, who become past feeling. Fatherlessness is the engine driving our most urgent social problems, from crime to adolescent pregnancy to domestic violence. Such outcomes, brothers and sisters, unfortunately constitute America's grossest national product, produced in the slums of the spirit created by spreading secularism. In Proverbs we read, "For the commandment is a lamp. Once darkened, a society loses its capacity to distinguish between right and wrong, and the will to declare that some things are wrong per se. Without the lamp, our world finds itself desperately building temporary defenses, drawing new lines, forever falling back, unwilling to confront. A society which permits anything will eventually lose everything." I have no hesitancy in stating, brothers and sisters, that unless checked, permissiveness, by the end of its journey, will cause humanity to stare in mute disbelief at its awful consequences. Do not, my young friends, expect the world to love the seventh commandment, chastity before marriage and fidelity after. Some people in the world will fret genuinely over the consequences of its violation, such as staggering and unprecedented illegitimacy and marital breakdowns. However, sexual immorality per se will still not be condemned by the secular world, as long as the violators have any commendable qualities at all, or as long as they are in some respect politically correct. We will have to keep the seventh commandment because it is correct, not because we will get much support from society's other institutions. Cultural decline is accelerated when single interest segments of society become indifferent to general values once widely shared. This drift is facilitated by the indifferent or the indulgent, as society is led carefully down to hell. Some may not join in this drift, but instead they step aside, whereas once they might have constrained, as is their representative right. Of such circumstances, Yeats lamented, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." For what happens in cultural decline, both leaders and followers are really accountable. Historically, of course, it's easy to criticize bad leaders, but we should not give followers a free pass. Otherwise, in their rationalization of their degeneration, they may say they were just following orders, while the leader was just ordering followers. However, much more is required of followers in a democratic society, wherein individual character matters so much in both leaders and followers.
Granted, brothers and sisters, the world is in commotion, but the kingdom is in forward motion as never before. Its distinctiveness is being more sharply defined by adverse trends in the world, where traditional values are not fastened down by the rivets of the Restoration, they are sliding swiftly.
Notably, at the last day, the adversary will not support those who followed him anyway. He cannot. Jesus will triumph majestically, and the adversary's clever constructs, pleasing to the carnal mind, will also collapse, and the fall thereof will be exceedingly great. Even now, one can see in the lives of the prodigals who come to themselves the devil's doctrines dripping in early meltdown. Many, having experienced the utter emptiness of the lower ways, are in a preparation to hear the word and now await being informed of the rescuing revelations and translations.
For over 40 years, in a spirit of love, members of the church have been counseled to be thrifty, self-reliant, avoid debt, pay tithes and generous fast offerings, be industrious and have sufficient food, clothing, and fuel on hand to last at least 1 year. Today, there are compelling reasons to re-emphasize this counsel. We heard it done effectively in that great welfare meeting this morning. May I add just a word? Members of the church are feeling the economic pinch of higher taxes and inflation, coupled with conditions of continuing recession. Some have come to their bishops seeking assistance to make house payments, car loans, and utilities. Unfortunately, there has been fostered in the minds of some an expectation that when we experience hard times, when we have been unwise and extravagant with our resources and have lived beyond our means, we should look to either the church or government to bail us out. Forgotten by some of our members is an underlying principle of the church welfare plan that, quote, no true Latter-day Saint will, while physically able, voluntarily shift from himself the burden of his own support. One of the first principles revealed to Father Adam when he was driven out of the Garden of Eden was this: in the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return to the ground. All we obtain in life of a material nature comes as a product of labor and the providence of God. Work alone produces life's necessities. In saying this, I'm aware of and sympathetic to the fight of many young families who are struggling to make ends meet. They're faced with the financial burden of providing for the three great necessities of life: food, clothing, and shelter. I am also sympathetic to the situation of widows and other sisters who rear families alone. More than even before, we need to learn and apply the principles of economic self-reliance. We do not know when a crisis involving sickness or unemployment may affect our circumstances. We do know that the Lord has decreed global calamities for the future and has warned and forewarned us to be prepared. For this reason, the brethren have repeatedly stressed a back to basics program for temporal and spiritual welfare. Today I emphasize a most basic principle: home production and storage. Have you ever paused to realize what would happen to your community or nation if transportation was paralyzed, or if we had war or depression? How would you and your neighbors obtain food? How long would the corner grocery store or supermarket sustain the needs of the community? Shortly after World War II, I was called by the First Presidency to go to Europe to reestablish our missions and set up a program for the distribution of food and clothing to the saints. Vivid in my memory are the people who got on trains each morning with all kinds of bric-a-brac in their arms to go out to the countryside to trade their possessions for food. At eventide, the train station was filled with people with arms full of vegetables and fruits and a menagerie of squealing pigs and chickens. You never heard such a commotion. These people were, of course, willing to barter practically anything for that commodity which sustains life: food. An almost forgotten means of economic self-reliance is the home production of food. We are too accustomed to going to stores and purchasing what we need. By producing some of our food, we reduce, to a great extent, the impact of inflation on our money. More importantly, we learn how to produce our own food and involve all family members in a beneficial project. No more timely counsel, I feel, has been given by President Kimball than his repeated emphasis to grow our own gardens. Here is one sample of his emphasis over the past 7 years. Quote, we encourage you to grow all the food that you possibly can on your own property. Berry bushes, grapevines, fruit trees. Plant them if your climate is right. Grow vegetables and eat them from your own yard. Many of you have listened to and done as President Kimball has counseled, and you have been blessed for it. Others have rationalized that they had no time or space. May I suggest that you do what others have done? Get together with several others and seek permission to use a vacant lot for a garden, or rent a plot of ground and grow your gardens. Some elders' quorums have done this as a quorum, and all who have participated have reaped the benefits of a vegetable and fruit harvest and the blessings of cooperation and family involvement. Many families have dug up lawn space for gardens. We encourage you to be more self-reliant, because the Lord has declared, notwithstanding the tribulation which shall descend upon you, that the church may stand independent above all other creatures beneath the celestial kingdom. The Lord wants us to be independent and self-reliant, because these will be days of tribulation. He has warned and forewarned us of the eventuality. Food production is just one part of the repeated emphasis that you store a provision of food which will last for at least a year, wherever it is legally permissible to do so. The church has not told you what foods should be stored. This decision is left up to individual members. However, some excellent suggestions are available in the booklet produced by the church entitled Essentials of Home Production and Storage. There are also booklets available on gardening at BYU. From the standpoint of food production, storage, handling, and the Lord's counsel, wheat should have high priority. There is more salvation and security in wheat, said Orson Hyde years ago, than in all the political schemes of the world. Water, of course, is essential. Other basics could include honey or sugar, legumes, milk products, or substitutes. The revelations to produce and store food may be as essential to our temporal welfare today as boarding the ark was to the people in the days of Noah. President Harold B. Lee has counseled, perhaps if we think not in terms of a year's supply of what we ordinarily would use, and think more in terms of what it would take to keep us alive in case we didn't have anything else to eat, that last would be very easy to put in storage for a year. Just enough to keep us alive if we didn't have anything else to eat. We wouldn't get fat on it, but we would live. And if you think in terms of that kind of annual storage, rather than a whole year's supply of everything that you are accustomed to eat, in most cases, which is utterly impossible for the average family, I think we will come closer to what President J. Reuben Clark envisioned way back in 1937. There are blessings in being close to the soil, in raising your own food, even if it is only a garden in your yard and a fruit tree or two. Those families will be fortunate who, in the last days, have an adequate supply of food because of their foresight and ability to produce their own. The counsel from church authorities has been consistent over the years and is well summarized in these words, quote, first and above and beyond everything else, let us live righteously. Let us avoid debt as we would avoid a plague. Where we are now in debt, let us get out of debt. If not today, then tomorrow. Let us straightly and strictly live within our income and save a little. Let every head of every household see to it that he has on hand enough food and clothing, and where possible, fuel also, for at least a year ahead. You of small means, put your money in foodstuffs and wearing apparel, not in stocks and bonds. You who have large means will think you know how to care for yourselves, but I may venture to suggest that you do not speculate. Let every head of every household aim to own his own home, free from mortgage. Let every man who has a garden spot garden it. Every man who owns a farm, farm it. You do not need to go into debt, may I add, to obtain a year's supply. Plan to build up your food supply just as you would a savings account. Save a little for storage each paycheck. Can or bottle fruit and vegetables from your gardens and orchards. Learn how to preserve food through drying and possible freezing. Make your storage a part of your budget. Store seeds and have sufficient tools on hand to do the job. If you are saving and planning for a second car or a TV set or some item which merely adds to your comfort or pleasure, you may need to change your priorities. We urge you to do this prayerfully and do it now. I speak with a feeling of great urgency. I have seen what the days of tribulation can be and can do to people. I have seen hunger stalk the streets of Europe. I have seen women and children ravage our army garbage dumps for scraps of food. Those scenes and nameless faces cannot be erased from my memory. I shall never forget the saints of Hamburg who appeared on the verge of collapse from starvation, or their small children whom I invited to come to the stand as we emptied our pockets of edibles. Most had never seen these items before because of the wartime conditions. Nor can I forget the expectant and nursing mothers whose eyes watered with tears when we gave them each an orange. We saw the terrible physical and social side effects of hunger. I cannot forget the French saints who, unable to obtain bread, used potato peelings for the emblem of the sacrament. Nor will I ever forget the faith of the Dutch saints who accepted our suggestion to grow potatoes to alleviate their own starving conditions and then sent a portion of their first harvest to the German people who had been their bitter enemies. The following year, they sent them the entire harvest. The annals of church history have seldom recorded a more Christ-like act of love and compassion. Too often, we bask in our comfortable complacency and rationalize that the ravages of war, economic disaster, famine, and earthquake cannot happen here. Those who believe this are either not acquainted with the revelations of the Lord, or they do not believe them. Those who smugly think these calamities will not happen, that they somehow will be set aside by because of the righteousness of the saints, are deceived and will rue the day they harbored such a delusion. The Lord has warned and forewarned us against a day of great tribulation and given us counsel through his servants on how we can be prepared for these difficult times. Have we heeded his counsel? I bear you my testimony that President Heber J. Grant was inspired of the Lord in establishing the church welfare program. The first presidency was inspired when they made the first public announcement in 1936 and declared the prime purpose of church welfare was to help the people to help themselves. I bear witness to that inspired council from 1936 to the present day that the saints lay up a year's supply of food. When President Spencer W. Kimball persistently admonishes the members to plant gardens and fruit trees and produce our own food, he is likewise inspired of the Lord. Be faithful, my brothers and sisters, to his counsel, and you will be blessed. Yes, the most blessed people in all the earth. You are good people. I know that. But all of us need to be better than we are. Let us be in a position so we are able to not only feed ourselves through the home production and storage, but others as well. May God bless us to be prepared for the days which lie ahead, which may be the most severe yet. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.